So tell me now. Now, I want an honest answer. Who actually wrote this book? Don't all speak at once.
Who
take turns.
It? Who typed it? Or who?
All right, let me rephrase the question. Whose idea was the story of Charlie Malarkey?
I started the story as a bedtime story to Brendan.
When I was four.
When he was 4 years old. And I don't know how far I got the first night, but it was far enough that it sounded okay, and I went back to it on a subsequent night to tell him another bedtime story. And that kept happening. And then pretty soon I ran out of things to say, and I suggest to him, what do you got in mind? What do you think is going to happen now to Charlie? And he might say something, he might not. I don't remember the process that clearly. But after a time, we had accumulated enough events and enough jokes and whatnot that I said, this is not a bad idea. We should make this into a children's book. So I took, I put it all down on paper. Not as a story, just as a series of notes. And after a while, I don't know, I was writing Legs at the time, and I took a couple of days off to try, you know, one day here and then maybe another day down the road to try to make some headway to get the book on paper. And I couldn't. I couldn't. It was like dead in the water. It was there was no spark of the imagination. And what happened then was that I brought Brendan into the picture and started from scratch. Brought him up to my office, and he was not quite as tall as the manuscript for Legs was at that time. And and he sat down in the rocker, and we would go back and forth. I'd say to him, what do you think happens now? And he, or what does the machine look like? What is a belly button machine? And so on. And he was, and then the book went, the story went. It was very magical. It was some, that kind of collaboration, the communion, the fact that he was there and he was inventing, and he was there to invent for. That was very important.
Well, Brendan, how did you feel when Bill dumped this manuscript in your lap, so to speak?
Well, I was too young to really know what it meant to, you know, a manuscript, what a manuscript was, what any procedure at all was to getting a book published, what publishing meant. And when it was finished and he read the finished product, I was probably like, great, I wrote a story or something. And I was, you know, I was happy about it, but I didn't really think it was, you know, anything particularly great. I mean, you know, I thought it was great, but I thought it was, you know, I didn't think it'd be published ever. And even if I did think it was published, I thought, you know, there's so many books around my house, I thought, you know, published with so many books, I had a very limited world, that, you know, books were, I thought there were so many of them, you know.
Well, you were, how old were you when you started working on this, this book?
Around four.
So this book was developed over quite a few years then, huh?
Well, I think it only took about a year. I mean, I think we actually finished it in about a year, maybe less than a year. And it got rejected a number of times. And
Ironweed all over again.
Then we waited for a couple of years, then we sent it around again. And got rejected again a number of times. And then after after Ironweed came out, we sent it around one more time, and it still got rejected by a couple of houses. And then finally the Atlantic said, you know, we'd like to do this. And so we got an illustrator, and they got an illustrator. I mean, we kind of...
Glenn Baxter.
Yeah, I guess your father taught you the meaning of rejection and how to ignore it. Well, Glenn Baxter is a real coup. He is a wonderful artist. I've had him in on the broadcast. Have you ever met him?
Yes, we had lunch with him one time, and we've corresponded with him over the past 2 years. And he's a very droll, funny man.
He's strange.
Yeah.
Strange. He sent me a postcard once, and it was signed from an Englishman. And I would never have thought to sign a postcard of mine from an American. No, it was from an English person. From an English person. So but his cartoons are quite unique, and so the combination of the story and Atlantic Monthly and these illustrations has made a very pretty book. And
yeah, we're very happy with it.
Yeah, it's well done. When Brendan, your father's been a writer for many years, and it wasn't until the last few years that he achieved some of the fame that he certainly deserved. How has this affected you and the family after all of the accolades and the awards and prizes and so forth that your father has received?
It's more fun. It's made it more. There's more things going on. The world is open to more things. I travel a lot more. It's different. I mean, you know, it's different from a lot of what my life and my friend's life are different in a lot of ways. You know, because of because he's famous or something. I mean, they're always saying, you know, say this book, for instance. I just had a party in New York, in Albany, and all my friends. A lot of them came to it, and they were just like, "Wow, this is really great." When I told them it was a book party, they were like, "Oh, great! You know, sit around and." But we really had a good time.
They thought you sat around and read books. Well, there probably are some added pressures on you. I was talking to one of Ernest Hemingway's sons, Jack Hemingway, a while ago, and he was going to private school upstate. He was never a very good student. He kept flunking out and didn't do too well in college either. I don't think he ever finished college. But part of the problems that he had in English, he would write a composition and
they'd compare it with his father.
The teacher would flunk him on it, and Jack would say, "Well, you know, Billy next at the next desk, my composition is as good as his." And the teacher would say, "Yes, but you're a Hemingway." Has this been a problem? You go to English class and you write a composition. Your teacher.
Well, my English teacher likes the way I write. Actually, he complimented me on it just the other day, which I thought was pretty strange. My teachers don't grade me according to my father, which is good. I mean, I guess they expect that I'll do well. And, I mean, I do reasonably well, but they don't, you know, say, "Well, you better do well because you're a Kennedy" or anything. They don't compare my work to my father's. I mean, they ask me questions about it sometimes, but that's about it.
Well, you're certainly too young, probably, to establish career goals at this time, but the literary background in your household, probably at some point or in some way, you'll probably make use of that, don't you think?
Well, what I'm interested in now, which is it's preliminary, I mean, I still have 2 years, year and a half, I want to go into film, I think. And, that'll definitely help in the film business. I don't know what I want to do in film, though. It's kind of up in the air.
Everybody wants to direct.
I don't know if I want to direct. I'd like to direct, but not until much later.
Well, Bill, what about your expectations for your family? Here is your 15-year-old son co-authoring. 16 now?
Yeah, 16. That's a typo.
Right, okay. Well, here is your teenage son co-authoring a book with you. I just wonder if it's difficult, as many parents find, not to put their children into the kind of position that we want them to be for ourselves. You know, we try to direct their lives, and this is a really an awkward thing. I mean, I've done this with my own kid who is 18. I would like for him to be something other than what he is, and I keep trying to channel him in that direction, and I find it doesn't work. What has been your experience?
Well, I think that the world that we're living in now, I mean my family, is conducive to a lot of opportunity for these kids, and the film world has opened up to them at the moment. Brendan is in no way under pressure from me to be a writer. This is a fluke. When we started this out, I believed in the story. I thought this is a pretty funny story, and then I read it to some kids and Brendan's first and second grade classes, and they liked it, and so I believed the children would like it eventually. But I never thought that Brendan would go on and become a writer or anything like that. It was just that his part in it, he deserved to be a co-author. And I still don't. I'm not of the opinion that kids should do what you want them to do, but certainly there are opportunities for him now that are somewhat extraordinary, I think, that have opened up to him, the film world, for instance. And both my daughters are working on the filming of Ironweed right now. And I wrote the screenplay for that, and they're shooting it up in our hometown, and in Albany. But Brendan is open to do anything he wants to do, and I think that this education in publishing and in invention and the use of the imagination is not a foreign thing to him. He had a wonderful imagination when he was very young, and he still does. He's now, both our American and British publishers are interested in a sequel to Charlie Malarkey, and Bren has started a new version. He's The Further Adventures of, I don't know what that won't be the title, but
what's going to be stolen this time?
We're not
some part
tell.
Of his anatomy.
No.
I won't ask which part. That might be an X-rated book by a 16-year-old kid. I mean, that would not be a thing that Atlantic Monthly would want to publish.
To read it.
Well, this is a kind of an X-rated book in a certain way by among certain book publishers, book editors, who felt it was a little too scary, a little too Freudian, a little too this and that to publish. That's one of the bases for the rejection, that it was somehow not suitable.
It wasn't a traditional kids' book.
It was what?
It's not a traditional goody-goody kids' book.
I didn't know they wrote those anymore.
Maybe they don't. We never had a model for anything except the old fairy tales were pretty horrendous themselves.
William Kennedy, I wish you could bring me up to date a little bit on what's happened since the last time I talked to you. Actually, I think that we chatted several months ago at a book fair on the west side of Manhattan, and you were signing. It was for Huntington's disease, I believe, and you were there as to benefit that fair. The previous time I talked to you, I guess we've chatted a number of times, but the previous time I think it was at the occasion of the publication of O Albany, but I'm not sure.
Could have been. Yeah.
Or maybe
a couple of shows.
Or maybe the paperback publication of one of the books. I can't remember, but
The Ink Truck.
The Ink Truck, the republication of The Ink Truck, that's right. Well, what has happened then, since we didn't really chat at the fair? I know that you've been working on Quinn's book, but can you kind of fill me in on what's been going on over the past year?
Well, Quinn's book is the major project that I'm involved in terms of writing. I began it when I was up at Cornell about 1982, and I've been working on it ever since with a number of interruptions, but it's going pretty well, I think, and I'm hoping maybe I'll finish by the middle of next year. I don't know. I'm hoping if I get on a roll, or if I have to work on the film too closely, then it'll be postponed that much longer. But
you wouldn't rush this book
thing.
Now, would you?
No, I mean,
you're
not trying to rush it.
It's so meticulous, I would hate to see you.
Well, 4 years on 200 pages is what I've 221 pages is what I've just finished, and now I'm on what is called book two within the novel, and that may be another 200 pages. I don't think it'll take me 4 years. I don't think it'll take me anything close, because so much of this time has been spent in research and reading and just trying to understand the 19th century and the history of immigration and this slavery situation and the Civil War and the condition of politics and journalism and theater and so on back then. And
well, let me ask you, in the writing of this book, do you find that writing becomes easier and more efficient as you hone your craft, or is it still as difficult knowing? I know writing is hard, and it is still as difficult as, say, the first book.
It's just as hard. It's, in a certain sense, because of this research, it's harder. There has to be so much grounding. I just can't go out and observe the world and write about it, or reimagine it from the real world. I have to go back and reconstitute the world and then depart from that imaginatively. So in that sense, it's harder. The prose comes more easily, I think, now, and with more control. And but the story, making it out of nothing, is no easier now than it ever was. But it is just as pleasurable, and I get as much satisfaction now as I got out of it when I was writing The Ink Truck, which was a lot of fun. And some things change, some don't.
How is this writing program up at State University in Albany coming along?
Well, it seems to be going very well. I run what's called the Writers Institute up there now, and that began as a fluke out of the MacArthur grant that I received. $15,000 went with it, and I could give that money to any institution that I chose to associate myself with. I gave it to the State University in hopes that they would use it to bring some writers in, and they immediately matched it with another 15 and asked us to set up something that would be of sizable importance, and we did. We brought in some major writers, Saul Bellow, Toni Morrison, and it was so successful that the legislature asked if I would run it, and if they made it permanent, and I said yes, I would. And they made it law in a matter of months, and Governor Cuomo signed it, and we now have the New York State Writers Institute at Albany, and it's been going out for 2.5 years.
Are you actively involved in
this?
Yes,
very much so, in recruiting and so on. One of my colleagues up there really is runs it on a day-to-day basis, Tom Smith, and another writer former student at SUNY, Gene Finley. They are, and the three of us are always working together to move the thing forward in another direction. We've been very successful in getting some of the best writers in the world to come visit us. This week we have Judith Malina is coming in from the Living Theater, and going to be in residence for a while, and Daniel Kish, the Yugoslav novelist, is in exile in Paris. He's coming in for a visit this week. And we had Mary McCarthy was in 2 weeks ago to give a lecture on a creative imagination. And I don't know, we've had so many. Hal Ashby, the movie director. We commissioned Toni Morrison's first play, Dreaming Emmett. Play about Emmett Till. We've had John Updike, Bill Styron, Norman Mailer, Joe Heller, Allison Lurie, Carolyn Kaiser, Seamus Haney, John Montague, and many more major Puerto Rican novelists, Cuban novelists. We're scouring the world all the time and trying to do as many things as writing allows, and journalism. Tom Wicker was up, and Tony Lucas was up a few weeks ago. talking about his book, Common Ground.
It sounds like a wonderful thing for the students up there.
It's a wonderful thing.
Probably an exposure
for the community
they've never had.
As well. It's not just for the students. We're drawing probably all, more from the community than from the student body. The students are not as enthusiastic as we hoped they would be. There are many, and when you have a film program, you get you tend to get the the intense film students will come to that. Or we had a Maisha Moponya, the South African playwright, recently, and we had a highly politicized audience, and we had Maurice Sendak come in, and he packed the place with his sort of enthusiasts, and people who had not been able to see Joe Heller in New York City came up from New York to see him in Albany. So it's getting very popular and very well known around that whole Northeast. And right now we're planning for a summer writers' conference for 4 weeks up at Skidmore in next summer in July and August. Two weeks in July and 2 weeks in August. And we have some really interesting writers. And
to whom is that conference going to be geared?
It's any writers who want to come in. It'll be people who want to take it for credit, or it'll be people who are just writers who want to study with these known figures.
When will this be?
At this stage, I think it's the last 2 weeks in July and the first 2 weeks in August, but I think you should check that out further and call the Writers Institute for Tom Smith, or call me at the...
Are you still working out of the Legs Diamond House, so to speak?
That's my office.
Legs Diamond House. You didn't put a plaque out front, I
guess. There was a plaque out front when I bought it. Somebody stole it.
Good for them. Well, how did you get involved in this band, Writers, the function that's going to be happening tonight?
Well, I joined the Pen Club a couple of years ago, and they called me up recently and said, would I read for this imprisoned, silenced writers program that they're having? And I said I would. And I think it's a terrific program that the Pen Club has, and to shine light on those awful dark corners in all parts of the world, and to help writers, it's a very worthy program, and I'm glad to support it. I'm going to read something from Isaac Babel, the great short story writer who rode with the Red Cavalry and the Cossacks in the 20s, and then wrote a bunch of short stories about it. It was a protege of Maxim Gorky, and was highly revered and very popular, and then silenced and disappeared in 1938 because he incurred the wrath of bureaucrats under Stalin. And
you're not going to read from Charlie Malarkey?
Not tonight.
We've well, been in prison, yes.
William Kennedy, thank you very much. Brendan Kennedy, thank you very much. I appreciate the fact that both of you took time out to come in and chat with me about Charlie Malarkey and the Belly Button Machine. I hope the book will be seen in all of the shelves in the children's sections of the bookstores, and that it becomes a perennial. It would be very nice.
I think that's a great idea.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right.